From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. The fourth quarter GDP number came out today, and it was surprisingly low. In fact, we're in negative territory. The number dropped by 0.1%, suggesting we produced fewer goods and services in the fourth quarter of last year than we did in the third. Joining us to explain what this means and doesn't, Matt Iglesias, Slate's business and economics correspondent, author of The Rent is Too Damn High, published in March. He joins us from the other Washington Today. Matt, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So we shouldn't be concerned about the economy contracting like this?
Well, you know, it's not good news anytime you see the economy shrink. But when you peer into it, the news isn't nearly as bad as it seems. The downturn came almost entirely from sort of companies drawing down inventories that they already had and from some cutbacks in military purchases. If you look at things like how much money were people making, how much stuff were people buying, how much investment was business doing, how many houses are we building, that all looks okay.
Did you expect it to rebound again in this coming quarter?
Yes, you would. So the inventory cycle is a little bit unusual, but sometimes businesses buy more stuff than they sell. Other times they sell more stuff than they bought. So when you have a big down quarter in inventories like we just did, you almost invariably have an up quarter the next time around. Businesses sold many more things than they bought from wholesalers. So next time around, they're going to need to increase their orders. Similarly with the military purchases. In the third quarter, we saw a 13% uptick in military purchases. Then in the fourth quarter went down 22%. That averages out to almost flat. So, you know, next time around, they're almost certainly going to need more stuff. For whatever reason, you know, there weren't a lot of completions of big defense projects in the last quarter, but it should come back.
It's been a few years, but we're off again on a round of debate and discussion about what to do with immigration, specifically the 11 million undocumented people in the United States. If we just look at this as an economic issue, if a path to citizenship is provided, one of the most controversial provisions being debated, it helps who, it hurts who?
Well, you know, what we know from the economics literature is that more educated people, people with college degrees, even people who finished high school, have tended to benefit from the presence of more immigrants in the United States. It creates more demand for the skills that we have when you have more people here with a different set of skills. Where there's controversy is on native-born Americans with very low levels of education. Some studies show it helps even them because, you know, native-born Americans tend to at least speak English, things like that. Others have shown a downward impact. Citizenship versus not citizenship probably doesn't have a huge economic impact per se, but anything that would tend to encourage more people to come here, you know, should help higher skilled, better educated Americans with possibly a negative impact on high school dropouts.
And you've got a couple of graphs that illustrate a slight difference of opinion. One group thinking that it's a slight improvement for those who don't have a high school diploma. Others saying it could take a 4.5% hit in wages to people who don't have a high school diploma. There's probably going to be a lot more attention focused on this as this debate heats up. How will we get accurate information to make a decision based on the impact on those folks?
Well, you know, it's a little bit difficult to know simply because the data sources aren't great. Now, if we have a big change in policy, that'll give us more data to look at it. One thing a lot of economists have studied is the Mariel boat lift that happened in the 80s,
right,
when a whole bunch of people from Cuba came to Miami very suddenly, because it was a rare case where it was really the Castro government rather than the American government that decided what happened. It looks there like wages did not decline for people in Miami. You know, so you could study the impact specifically on the Miami area versus the rest of the country. And you didn't see like some kind of wage collapse in Miami. And where you did see wages go down was among Miami residents who only spoke Spanish, right? So an influx of people who were very, very similar to them put a sort of negative pressure there. But for all Miami people who had English language skills seemed to do okay or even benefit.
Matt Iglesias, Slate's business and economics correspondent, is my guest. Our Senator, Patty Murray, is the new Senate leader on the budget. What does that portend for a settlement in this ongoing budget and deficit dispute?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it particularly raises the chances of a settlement, but it does mean that the Democratic caucus is going to be, I think, much more politically effective than it was under her predecessor. Murray is much more in line with sort of where Democrats as a whole are, that, you know, she's from a coastal state. She's a fairly conventional, moderately liberal Democrat. That's what most of her colleagues are. Kent Conrad, who had that job before Senator Murray, was a little bit of an oddball. He was very, very serious budget budget hawk at a time when the prospects for making a deal were not that good. And so he wound up sort of getting his wires crossed with other Democrats a lot. Patty Murray comes to this from having run the senatorial campaign committee very successfully, from having done sort of a lot of political work, caucus leadership work, and is going to bring those skills to the budget committee.
Now, Patty Murray, of course, was also co-chair of the so-called super committee in 2011 that failed to come up with a deal to lift the debt ceiling. But you're right, that was a political victory. Why was that?
Well, you know, her real role on that committee was to keep the Democrats together, right? Was to make sure, obviously, Democrats wanted to get a deal. Their hope was that Republicans would agree to some tax increases, in which case a deal would get done. But the fear was that Democrats were going to bolt and were going to agree to a Republican all-cuts plan. And so Murray's real task there was to sort of hold her side together and keep them uniform and see if they could stare the GOP down. As it turned out, Republicans didn't break, but she did her part, right? She kept Democrats together. They held firm on their line. And then eventually, when the so-called fiscal cliff arose, Republicans did agree to some tax increases.
Well, it's a couple years later. There are a couple more Democrats in the U.S. Senate. What does Murray's political effectiveness and her ability to keep Democrats together mean for just kind of closing the deal, coming to some kind of agreement with Republicans and getting something kind of finally done on this?
Well, you know, it means that the onus, I think, rests with them, that you have Democrats in the White House, you have Democrats controlling the Senate, you have a Democratic caucus in the Senate that's unified. It's both larger than it was last time, and it's also more liberal. Then you have a majority in the House, a Republican majority that's quite conservative, but also got narrower. And so the question is, you know, do they want to make a compromise? The president has been very clear that he is happy to sort of cut entitlement programs, but he wants to get some tax increases in exchange. That deal's been on the table for a couple years. It's clear that Republicans aren't going to get a better deal than that. So do they want to make the deal? I mean, how badly do they want to see spending cuts versus how much do they want to keep taxes low in the short term?
Well, Matt, it's interesting to hear your take on Patty Murray. I think here in Washington State, we lose perspective on how effective our lawmakers are in the other Washington. Aside from what you've told us, what's the line on Patty Murray and her ability to get things done as a senior ranking senator? Now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When she was first tapped for that super committee role, I think it took a lot of people by a mild amount of surprise. She hadn't had a very high profile in Washington. And when she was given the DSCC job, it was seen as almost a desperation move, that nobody wanted that job. And so Harry Reid turned to Senator Murray. But she really impressed a lot of people in both roles. Democrats did much better than people were expecting in the Senate elections, which was, you know, not all to her, but certainly relates to her credit. She recruited some very strong candidates. They held the line on the super committee. She's taken more of a role engaging with the national press than she had before. She's staffing up with the budget committee. And I think her stock has sort of risen a lot in Washington, D.C. as a leader and as, you know, an ally of Harry Reid and of Chuck Schumer and a real member of the leadership team.
I'm speaking with Matt Iglesias. He's Slate's business and economics correspondent. You recently compared Apple and Amazon. Some observers see Apple stumbling lately. Do you?
Well, you know, Apple did stumble. Its earnings came in at a lower than expected level, and its stock really, really plunged in response to that. The contrast with Amazon is interesting because Amazon's earnings didn't just disappoint. They actually fell, and they fell by quite a lot, by 45%. But the stock wasn't hammered at all, and that's because Amazon and its CEO have simply a different relationship with their shareholders and with Wall Street than Apple does.
Well, how is it a different relationship?
Well, you know, Jeff Bezos has sold the investing community on the idea that Amazon is a long-term growth company, that the market for online retail is going to grow and grow and grow in the future, and that Amazon's job is simply to show that it can dominate that space and keep growing its sales. So people are happy to ignore the question of profit margins. Amazon, in a good quarter, makes a very thin profit margin. In a bad quarter, they even actually lose money. They're sort of right there on the knife's edge. But their job, as Wall Street sees it and as Bezos sees it, is to sort of execute competently. And they really do it. I mean, nobody disputes that if you want to buy something online, you know, you go to Amazon. They're great at digital downloads. They're great at physical delivery. They do great services. Apple is a company that's built on high profit margins. People look quarter after quarter and say they can't possibly keep making a 40-45% margin. But that means that we expect them to do it. And anytime they slip a little, even when they come in with a margin 36% that Amazon would kill to get, it's a disappointment because it comes in below what they've done before, and people don't have a clear sense of what's the company's sort of plan for tomorrow.
You know, Apple iPad sales have not been what they would have liked it to be. There are some who speculate that the iPad mini is cannibalizing those sales. How does this competition play out when it comes to hardware? Because we've got Amazon also making e-readers and products that in some ways are challenging what Apple has pioneered.
Well, right. That's exactly to the point. So Amazon comes out with the Kindle Fire, which is not so good. Then the Kindle Fire HD, which people really like. And they sell those things for essentially what it costs to produce them. It's a zero profit margin. And then Apple had the iPads, which were out and were earning, I think, about a 40% profit margin. So in response to the rise of the Kindle HD, they had to come out with the iPad mini, which is a lower margin product. Still much higher than anything Amazon sells, but low by Apple standards. And so that's sort of shaken people's confidence in Apple. They think that to compete with Amazon, Apple's going to have to bring its margins down. And because Apple is a company whose value proposition has always been based on these high margins, it's hurt them on Wall Street. Whereas Amazon, as I said, you know, Wall Street is willing to take on faith that if Amazon keeps growing, the profits will eventually follow. So that gives them a very strong position.
Matt Iglesias, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Matt Iglesias, Slate's business and economics correspondent. He joined us from the other Washington.